How does it feel being out of Brooklyn? Are your palms of your hands sweaty?
You mean now that I'm in Manhattan?
Yeah.
Well, going over the bridge is always a bit of an emotional experience.
Hyperventilating at all?
Hyperventilating. No, it's I like New York, as a matter of fact. A lot of people think Brooklynites are terribly parochial, but we do have some mad feeling about the place. I think partly the way it's laid out, you know, hasn't got that symmetry of Manhattan that makes people feel more at ease with the parallel avenues. I think it streets more or less that kind of grid that is Brooklyn is. Nowhere and everywhere, it just sprawls out.
And well, one of your neighborhood tales, of course, you took a long trip throughout Brooklyn and even got lost yourself a little bit.
That's right, yes.
You had to abandon your car and find your way home without it. What happened?
Well, I decided to really take the trip, you know, into the interior, because Brooklyn seems so forbidding to so many people, and I wanted to see where it led to, because I stayed pretty much in my own neighborhood, which people do, and I knew Coney Island and Brooklyn Heights pretty well, but I didn't know those forbidding places like Canarsie, Greenpoint.
Current, isn't it?
Current. They used to call it Greenpoint, yeah.
All those Brooklyn accents, they don't exist anymore.
No, they don't.
To Queens and Long Island and Staten Island.
They moved. Brooklyn has a pretty good, stable vowel consonant mix, I think. A little sloppy, but...
Well, the Brooklyn accent nowadays is called a Jersey accent. Joysy accent.
I didn't know that. Isn't that nice? Yeah. See, but Brooklynites don't care particularly what people think about them. They don't mind the jokes.
But you're from Brooklyn Heights. That's
right.
Not really Brooklyn, is it?
Well, it's not really Brooklyn now. As soon as they raised the rents, it became another borough. It got over-gentrified, you see. As a result, it lost the homogenous quality that so much of Brooklyn used to have when I grew up in it. It became very specialized, you know. The people with briefcases, very nice, but bringing a flavor of affluence, which, you know, made me feel ill at ease. And so that made it special in that sense. I think any area that is shaken up sociologically somehow, whatever, it seems different. The streets are cleaner, you know.
Yeah, well, it's a lovely area. I love Montague Street. And, you know James Purdy, by chance?
Yes, I know James Purdy. We meet every day, and sometimes we throw barbed words at people we don't like in the business.
I occasionally take him out for lunch. There's a little Chinese, a little Italian restaurant he likes on Montague Street.
Oh, yes.
Usually on a Saturday, I'll go pick him up. And he's one writer who almost literally lives in a garret.
That is right. He's a very sweet man and dedicated. Makes me feel like I'm a lazy writer. And without rancor toward other writers, you know, that rare person who says, you do your work, I'll do my work. And I like him, yes.
Yeah, he's a very interesting man. And are you still living in the same apartment house that you referred to in the book?
Yes.
How long have you lived there?
About 30 years, maybe, 25, 30 years, yeah.
So you've lived all your life in Brooklyn?
Well, yes, because I grew up in Coney Island. However, I've taken an occasional foray. You know, I went to school briefly in Michigan, and I actually visited Alaska. Yeah, so I occasionally used to do freelance writer, and I did some documentary films, one in Alaska, took place in Alaska. As a matter of fact, I was very famous in this town of Alaska, Nome, Alaska, because when they found out I came from Brooklyn, it's one of those mad, inexplicable things. They all took on something mythic. Brooklyn, they kept saying. They kept buying me drinks. So that's how they felt about it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to use that word.
I'm from
Brooklyn to buy me drinks.
Well, they did. But, yes.
I wanted to ask you a couple of things.
Sure.
Now, you are the poet laureate of Brooklyn. Now, poet laureates are very hard to come by. In fact, I think Connecticut was talking about having one. I don't know if they actually did. New York State has talked about it having a state laureate. I don't know if that ever came about, did it? I think the closest we've ever had to a poet laureate has been the head of the Librarian of Congress, I think it is.
That could be Librarian
of Congress, something like that. Well, tell me all about how you became poet laureate of Brooklyn.
First, you mentioned Connecticut. They just appointed a poet laureate, James Merrill, in a very worthy laureate.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, remember that Robert Penn...
That's official now.
Yes. And Robert Penn Warren, who was the laureate of the United States, you might say, he was the Library of Congress laureate, lives in Connecticut. So Connecticut had... There are some, South Dakota, Florida, there's some. Well, I became a poet laureate only the way a Brooklyn person can become a poet, no other way. It seems that somebody in the administration of Howard Golden, the way I put it together later, used to read books, actually, and he writes poetry.
Howard Golden?
Howard Golden.
Reading books?
No. I said someone in...
Someone in his administration.
Yeah, somebody apparently who knew I was a poet. But I'd written half a dozen books and some novels and poetry, and my themes were Brooklyn themes. One of my early, my first novel was called Under the Boardwalk. It's about growing up in Coney Island, you see. And I wrote about Coney Island occasionally, articles. So somebody got the idea that, hey, there's a guy here who writes about Brooklyn, loves Brooklyn. Why don't we induct him into something? And he suggested, I think it was Brooklyn historian, there is one, or a friend of his, contacted me and said, would you like to be the poet laureate? Nice, very informally. It was very nice. You know, like, what are you doing next week? Like, you're the poet laureate. And I said, well, yes, but there's a couple of other people that I think should be ahead of me, you know, that Marion Moore. But, of course, she would recently deceased, come to think of it. And some of the better-known figures, like Walt Whitman, they were a long time gone, and Hart Crane, but I still felt that, you know, a bit of an honor that possibly I didn't earn.
And
however,
you're the only poet left in Brooklyn.
Yes, I'm the only. And the main thing is, he said, well, you live so close to the Borough Hall building. I do live down the street a couple of blocks. It was all good-natured, you see, and friendly, as it befits a small town. And I think handled in a way that it can only have been handled in Brooklyn. You see, if they would announce a poet laureate in Manhattan, such is the competitive spirit there among writers, there would be, blood would have hit the streets, you know. They would have been screaming, why should he be poet laureate? I think this poet is better than a lot of excellent poets. In my case, you see, I think they thought, well, why not? He's a decent fellow. He never committed a crime, and he wants it, or he'll accept it. So that's the poet laureate story. And
well, it must be a very lucrative position.
Oh, yes, very lucrative. I was told I would get $1 a year, which didn't bother me so much because there were years I didn't make much more than that. Anyway.
Did they pay you in installments?
Well, they pay. They gave me the one first dollar, actually. It was signed by Howard Golden, the borough president, and the bottle of sherry.
As a check? The dollar was in the form of a check?
No, cash.
He gave you cash?
Yeah, gave me cash.
Well, that's what politicians do these days.
That's right. They didn't want anything on the record. And when I reminded him a year later, just meeting him on the street, I always used to do that. I said, Howard, how come, you know, I didn't get my second year salary? Oh, Norman. He said, we have so many budgetary problems. You're going to come up with that dollar. So I never got paid. But that's all right. It's like in any honorary title. You don't expect to get paid.
You haven't been paid?
No, not since then. I shouldn't really say this, you know.
The power of broadcasting will probably...
That's right. Howard, I'm sorry. They forced it out of me.
Were you designated poet laureate?
About 5 years ago, maybe.
And you only... So they owe you $4?
They owe me $4 big. And I did one sort of official poem, you know. The whole thing is, what would you do? And I said, well, you tell me what to do, you see. I did write the centennial poem for the Brooklyn Bridge, which was read the night of that big... You know, 1883 celebration. I read it under the bridge on one of the boats. It was very impressive. I like that. That's when I really felt I was the poet laureate, you see.
So what happens? You have ceremonial poetry readings?
No, but then nothing happened. That's the nice thing about it. You know,
given one official reading?
Yeah, I gave a reading, and the poem was published and distributed, you know. But, in Brooklyn, everybody's busy doing his own thing. Once in a while, I would meet Howard Golden on the street, and he said, how's the poet laureate doing? And I said, pretty good, Howard.
Well, you're not the only famous Norman in Brooklyn, are you?
That's right.
Tell me about the other one.
The other Norman is referred to in my book as the other Norman, very mysteriously, capital O, capital N. And I haven't spoken to Norman, who's a friend of mine, since the book came out. He may have read it. I sent it to him, and I hope he took it in good spirit. He's the other Norman that people continually whisper about. Like they say, the other Norman is doing this, and what are you doing? Or someone would say, are you Are you writing a new book? Because the
he's a writer, too?
Oh, yes, he's a writer, too. And I would meet him occasionally in the book, which I do. We meet at a place called the Lunch Club every two or three weeks with David Levine, the very famous caricaturist, you know, cartoonist, whatever you will. And the three of us would meet, and we'd talk about things. You know, we didn't talk about writing. We talk about money. Isn't that exciting? Contracts.
Well, I know that's a lot on the other Norman's mind.
Yeah, that's right. And, it's funny how we didn't talk about aesthetics. We thought that was not even about women too much. We were interested in food, and Norman loved food, and he'd say, look, when I come here, I want to eat. Well, can't answer that.
Well, in your book, Neighborhood Tales, you certainly make it appear that this is indeed a neighborhood, because you seem to be able to walk out of your apartment and hail people, or the friendly policeman who tries to wait 10 minutes before putting a ticket on the car, you know.
Oh, yes. They not only that, warning people that they're going to take that street. You'd say, better get your car out. We're coming through later. And, well, it is a neighborhood. All groupings in the city are really neighborhood, but for me, it's particularly good because my instinct is for the streets. I got that growing up in Coney Island. You know, I lived in the street a lot as a kid, and I'm out on the streets. It occurred to me that most of the stories are in the street. Not many take place interior-wise. Someone pointed that out to me, which was startling. So it does deal with the exterior environment very heavily, and people tell you things. When they found that I was the poet laureate, you see, word got around. They came with their stories, their problems. They thought I had some kind of powers of a shaman, you know, that I could do something.
Oh, before you go,
yes.
Remind me, I have an envelope full of my own poetry I'd like for you to read and critique. There'll be maybe $25 in it.
Oh, yes. Well, I've hit those people occasionally. Generally very polite to them and generally try and push them away, but I think...
But people do give you their poems.
Well, one of the things that happened, it's a story, but it's true. See, many of these stories are events that are mostly true, as they say, true stories, but some of them begin with true situations, and I fictionalize around them. So I've treated them very freely. Of a man in the neighborhood who came to me with some poetry, and he said, I don't know if I'm a poet. He said, he was a middle-aged fellow, very buoyant, very youthful. He says, I don't know, I've been writing, could you tell me if I'm a poet? And I figured, well, this is going to look like a bad thing. But he brought the poems to the house. I said, if you leave them in the hall and don't bother me, I may look at them. But he was very, very nice. He didn't. He phoned up. He said, I left them there. And one evening, I figured I'll take it. For my conscience sake, I'll look at one, figuring I would, to my astonishment, which happens, they were quite good. You know, they were quite good. So I could really say to him, which I enjoyed doing, you know, you're a poet. As the poet laureate, I say to you, you are the poet. Oh, he loved it. And he really was good. And later, Meredith, his name was, steered him to a place, to a magazine, to get one of his poems published. He was just delighted. So that's the things we like to do in Brooklyn. I don't know what they do in the Bronx and Queens.
And to your credit, of course, you did not pilfer any of his poems.
No, but he had some very good lines there.
Are you still looking for a place to park that Dodge Dart? It is a dart.
No, it's a falcon.
A falcon, yeah.
Well, there's a story about that. It's really a Valiant, but it's also a falcon. It took cars merged into one. I did something bad for my conscience. I took two cars. However, it's a street car. What we call. I have a chapter
car
called
on the street.
but I call the car on the street a street car named Falcon. For those who remember street car named Desire, I wanted a street car named Falcon. Well, half the city, two-thirds of the city parks on the street. You must know that. Do you? I mean, there's just simply not like garage space.
I thought 100% of the city
parks on
the
maybe
street.
100.
Every time I look for a parking place, I can never find one.
They're all over the streets, and it sort of helps the economy. It's sort of mild theft going on and reselling of things. I was told that that's very good. If you steal some tires, you resell them. At any rate, I still park on the street. Yeah.
In fact, I found out that there are people here in Manhattan who pay more for their parking space than I pay for my apartment.
Absolutely. And that, to me, is another one.
Of course, it's a much better neighborhood than mine.
Yeah, and they make you do something because you can get away with it, but sooner or later you get hit with a ticket or two. You can't even you can't even get rid of a car in the city because they'll track you down somehow and they'll say, why don't you try to get rid of the car? You have to murder the car, throw it in the river.
Yeah, you have to file the registration number off of it somehow.
Yes, you have to hide. You have to. Isn't that amazing? But we all live here.
Brooklyn Heights, there are no parking garages that I can remember.
Very few.
Maybe around Borough Hall, a couple.
That's right. No, it's all street. Yeah. High-class street parking. You know, Mercedes-Benz nestling next to 1960 Dodges.
Because every time I drive into Brooklyn Heights, I find that there are these signs saying no parking because I think it's a fire zone because the fire trucks have to pull around these narrow streets.
Yeah. So that you lose a lot of spaces, actually. But what the people do, which is very naughty, you know, they just simply take the signs down often, which is dangerous, but they do. These are perfectly respectable people. Yeah, it gives them more space, you see, but the fire trucks and the fire wouldn't be able to swing wide, you see. But, you know, you get...
You can swing wide and smash a car.
Listen, you get desperate when you... Well,
don't worry about it.
You know, and I have The Last of the Spacemen. I don't need to point the chapters in my book, but meanwhile, I give the people an idea. The immense range of this book, I have a title, a chapter called The Last of the Brooklyn Spacemen. People used to think it was some sort of space, going up in space, until I had explained that these are the spacemen, the people that need the spaces to live in the street, to park their car. And I construct a real drama of what happens when neighbor turns against neighbor, and they spy on each other to see who's going to get what space, which hasn't come to that quite, but...
Well, yeah. But there have been murders over parking spaces outside of Brooklyn, of course. It would never
happen. Yeah, no, in Brooklyn, they'd probably challenge you to a duel, but it wouldn't go.
Yeah. There are a couple of really neat bookstores. Biblo Books and Charlie Brown's.
In Brooklyn?
Yeah, Brooklyn Heights. You know Biblo Books, don't you?
No, do I, or have I been asleep?
Oh, how could you miss that? They're almost side by side down on...
Is that...
Not Geronimo Street.
No, is that on Hicks Street? Sort of maybe way Hicks up or down?
It's down closer to the bridge.
That's right, yes. Now I do remember.
Yeah, they're charming, especially Biblo Books. I go there every couple of weeks.
But we've lost some good bookstores. This is one of the real problems.
The community bookstore.
Yeah, community bookstore. And then before then, there was a gorgeous bookstore, you know, the kind owned by a man who loved books. Now you don't get that anymore. The big chain, you know, God bless
them. Dalton is on that street, isn't it?
No, I don't think there's one in the Heights. Walden Books is.
There's a Walden Books?
Yeah, there's Walden Books.
I know there was a big chain store there.
And it's tremendous, but they don't. They do not concentrate on books.
They ever give you a window display?
Yes, they did, finally. They did a very excellent one. Tremendous. I took one look at that window, and I figured, I guess I made it in Brooklyn. Now, they had 100 books there, and I had a signing, which we like to do. And apparently, if you, in person, are there when your book is placed, and you sign the book, it does something. People want a book that's signed. I think they mistakenly think it's going to be worth more. But maybe not that. I think it's the presence that they can actually say, I bought this book from the man who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to try to tell them that has nothing to do with the book. We want them to like the book, what's it between the covers, not by how we look, but there's the tendency everywhere, you know, to make stars out of us, the star system idea, and that the writer has special eminence.
Well, what about your poetry? Is that kept in print?
Yes, my poetry's kept in print. I have a selected poems, and I still am a poet, but I emphasis more on fiction now. Yes, I do poetry readings. Whenever I'm invited, and now I do book readings for my book, because that seems to get a poetry reading in the Brooklyn Museum just last weekend. It was an awful day. It rained. And we had to go indoors. We lost the great space outdoor in the sculpture court of the Brooklyn Museum. As a result, you know, the rain scared away a lot of people. But that was fun, too, because there were not too many people, but they enjoyed it, and it looked like a little party. I read the books, and we promptly sold 7 copies or some fantastic figure.
You've also written about Marilyn Monroe. You have a book about Marilyn Monroe,
yes,
who also appears in your collection of essays, Neighborhood Tales. Tell me about Marilyn Monroe. How did you ever bump into her?
Oh, well, that's a real story. Well, I start on that. It's going to be... a bit of how I met her and bumped into her is in that story called Marilyn in Neighborhood Tales. And married her. She was brought to the house by a photographer, you see, friend. unrecognized because she came out of the rain, that kind of thing. And just to dry up and change her stockings and get some coffee until we realized it was the one, you see, and that...
She had already reached prominence at that
point. She was at the quite close, you know. She was ready to break out independently as an independent producer and do the big film. So we met her then, and she told my wife and I, and she told us later that she felt so at home there because we, despite the fact that we didn't know who she was, we, you know, coffee, my wife said, let me give you a pair of new stockings because your feet are wet, and we treated her like a human being who just needed a little attention. So she liked that. And since we didn't, and we were friends with her until literally the day of her death.
I understand, I think you made reference in here, you actually talked to her on the day of her death.
Yes,
on the phone.
Yes. We were one of the few, my wife and I both talked to her the day, the evening before she really went and...
What was that discussion about?
It was about the excitement of her coming to New York on a visit. And then that we were all to go to Washington to see a play, which set up all the vibrations of, you know, who was in Washington at that time.
I so think her Kennedy. Death was really unexpected, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah. But then later, people said, well, it wasn't suicide, it was, who knows, murder, who knows. They say, I don't know, they asked me, and I said, how could I tell?
But there was no inkling when you talked to her.
No. She just was happy to come east and get away. She was having difficulty picking up her career, which had been in disarray. And that's it. And then the next morning at coffee, there was the news. Oh, it was shocking. Really.
But you maintained a friendship with her for a long time.
Yes, for about almost 10 years.
And you surprised a lot of people. For example, the fellow at the gas station drove up.
That's right. Yeah, that was one of the things. I was happy I could get that story in. I didn't know where to tell it. But Neighborhood Tales, you see, it was perfect. It's a big dragnet, you see. It was something of the neighborhood when she came down. She used to come visit us, and that man who ran the gas station owner named Benny, elderly guy, looked like an aging Mickey Rooney, you know. He was a little man, very bouncing around, et cetera. And he knew that I had known her because it was in the papers and some gossip columns occasionally. And he kept saying, oh, I'd love to meet a guy. What I'd give to me? I said, what would you give to me, Benny? He said, I'd give a year's worth of free gas, he would say to me. And I said, well, you know, who knows? But anyway, to speed this along, when she came one afternoon for a visitor, one evening, I says, how'd you like to get some gas with a friend of mine? At any rate, we drove up in a white Cadillac. I do recall that. She at the wheel, and I next to her. And Benny came out, and he looked at us, and he just stood there. And then he walked over, and he said, you're Marilyn Monroe, aren't you? Oh, he says, how nice that you came to say hello to me. And the thing about that story is that he was so at ease with her, you see. And he reached over to shake her hand, because I remember that detail. And it was the hand of a garage man. It was dirty, greasy. And she took his hand without any qualms, shook his hand. And they chatted, and he said, is it true? Are you going to marry Arthur Miller? You think they'd known each other for 5 years. He just married. He's totally at ease, and she laughed, and et cetera. And after a while, you know, she had to leave. The customers were coming in, but... I thought of that. I thought of what the handshake meant. You know, and she said to me later, you know why I liked him? Because he didn't clean his hand. He presented himself to me as he was. He was a garage man. And I thought, making my point a bit, that she too extended her hand. And she paid a terrible price for that, including her death.
Well, did you get the year's supply of gas?
Oh, I got... I'll tell you, he charged me practically. See, he claimed that he got a lot of extra gas. I don't know how true this is, for evaporation. I never checked this out. So he would say, well, give me $5 for a tank for gas. I said, how could you afford to do that, Benny? He says, well, I get extra gas because they allow evaporation of underground tanks, so I'm giving you the gas that would evaporate. I bought that. Then I didn't sound true, though I was told that they do spill in another 25 gallons somehow or other. Hope I'm right. I never argue when people want to give me anything, you see.
Well, let me leaf through here, refresh my memory. I've been pumping you for little nidbits and...
Nidbits, well...
Tidbits out of
I'll tell you what people... can I say you something about what I...
Sure.
When I read, I find that there's one little story, part of the story, that always seems to attract people. I'm amazed. Well, it has to do with my old car, you see. It's
turned
out a dozen years old, about, give or take. And I always read that little sequence of a streetcar named Falcon. They're enraptured. I don't know why. Somehow I seem to bring that old car, sort of battered, to life for them. And once they were so intrigued, and they said, well, where is that car now? I mean, where do you keep it, et cetera? I said, well, I happen to have the car right outside. I did a reading at a little theater in Brooklyn, and they came out, about at least a dozen, at the end to look at that car. And all it was a wreck. But somehow I'd given it a character, which I did do, and I feel... very close to that car.
Well, let's hear it. Let's hear from the poet laureate about the Falcon.
Well, I could do a short little piece of it. It's a story, but I could, let's say, I'll just cut into it so it doesn't take too long. Write a minute or two. Will that be okay?
Yeah. What page is that?
Well, it's page 38. One day I went out to look for my streetcar. It's 12 years old, with fading paint, telltale signs of body rust, and a sad, neglected appearance. A streetcar is a particularly sturdy kind of vehicle, immune to climate and most bacteria. It survives unsheltered, unlike its delicate cousin, the garage car. Such car, furthermore, needs a careful owner or it risks being displaced. It is a car parked on so many streets that one can often lose track of it. I have always feared such a memory loss. The thought of my Falcon, abandoned, laden with undeserved parking tickets, abused by dogs or mischievous children, is too much to bear. I'm careful to make a sharp mental note from where it is after I park. And it goes on a bit with loving description. A few months ago, it appeared the Falcon and I had come to a parting of the ways. A tow truck swooped down and, well, you know the story. I journeyed to the car pound where I faced an $85 retrieval fee. 85. The market value wasn't much higher. I hurried to where the car was parked along the piers. Should I take one last look and walk away? It seemed a perfectly reasonable ending to a long friendship. I looked at this honorable streetcar, heavy with urban film, bruised and dented, sagging slightly on weakened springs. It was metal and glass, but at this moment I felt it had a soul. Thoughts of those years of reliability raced through my mind. I particularly recalled one evening in winter, around midnight, in a long-term parking lot at Kennedy Airport. I had just arrived on a flight from Denver after a holiday of ecstatic skiing, and, skis on my shoulder, alighted from the airport bus in this deserted area. There had been a storm, and the lot was covered with deep snow. I trudged against a sharp wind to where my Falcon waited, half hidden in a drift. It was about 10 degrees above zero. A white moon floated overhead, good for poets but bad for anyone about to start a car that had been standing idle for a week and looked frozen. Skis and equipment inside, I sat behind the wheel and inserted the ignition key. It was a moment of truth. I said aloud, fervently, "Baby, we're miles from the garage. I can't hail a cab. You're cold, I'm cold, your spark plugs are coated with ice, not to mention oil at the firing gaps. But I beg you to start. If you start, I'll buy you new brakes and tires. I'll love and cherish you. Just don't fail me now." I turned the key. The Falcon groaned, coughed once, and victory! I wouldn't say I wept with emotion, but if I could have stretched my arms around this metal shape, I would have hugged her, him, it. The motor hummed, and I remember shouting in the cold, "I'll never leave you!" Not only snowy nights of triumph, but rainy mornings as well. How often a neighbor would show up with an embarrassed grin and say, "I can't start my new Volvo and I'm late for work. Can I borrow your heap?" It always starts in the rain. Such words are a comfort, yet at that moment in the car pound, I realized that my Falcon, sturdy in spirit, was at a ripe old age. Well, I was not going to leave that body and spirit there. Painfully, I wrote out the required check. The car was mine again. Ignition on. Reprieved. Could it be, as I drove off, the sound of galloping hooves in the air? Falcon, away!
That's true poetry.
Well, it's fun, and it's... There are a lot of cars like that in the neighborhood.